would be a good thing.
Yeah,
it's absolutely terrific. I've been coming here for years, and that's one of the best I've ever heard.
We can stop.
Did the Protestant Reformation have something to do with this idea that they wanted to see it themselves? And if it did, then what about Galileo?
That's a terrific question, as you would expect. The Protestant Reformation ties into this in a gigantic way. Science in Italy had led the world in Galileo's day. Italy becomes a backwater after the church persecutes him. The vanguard of science moves to England. What happened is that in Galileo's time, the church took science to be an enemy of religion and squelched it. And in England, for complicated reasons, science was seen as a way of paying homage to God. Look at the magnificence of his creation. And therefore, scientists were seen not as subverting biblical truths, but as enhancing our appreciation of them. It made an enormous difference to have state and official support for science, and England zoomed ahead.
I guess I was wondering if Luther's idea that everyone should interpret the Bible, well, I'm Jewish, and this isn't, I'm way out of my comfort zone. But my understanding was that the Reformation was about the fact that you didn't have to rely on the church to tell you everything, and that whatever the church said was the way things were, that it was okay to think for yourself.
Yes, that ties into this in a giant way. The notion of thinking for yourself about religion or about what's happening when you put a candle in the spell jar, they do all tie together. The idea is that one of the first mottos of the Royal Society is, in effect, out of the library, into the laboratory. Don't look at what someone had told you about this. Let's sit around and see what happens. And then we'll do it in public, and then we'll write up the answer in plain English. This is all new and astonishing at the time, and by many people seen as quite a bad idea, in fact.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Hi. It sounds like Newton's discoveries at the time and other people supported or meshed with the mysticism of the time, the religion. Yet now these same ideas are considered the basis for atheism, why so many scientists are not religious. So were these empirical discoveries of the society and these applications of ancient geometry something that actually changed and moved away from religion, or is that totally decoupled then from the secularism we've seen over the last 200 or 300 years?
Well, that's a really good question. In fact, there's
a book about it?
There's a book that really gets into this. Here's part of the fun of the story. Newton and his peers are doing all their science explicitly to pay homage to God. Look what we found. Look how great this God is. He's much better than you would have thought, because you, in your unlearned ways, merely thought he had done dazzling things, and we can show you precisely how dazzling they are. That's Newton's message. That's his motivation. But the lesson that people draw from his success is, by God, the universe works according to these laws. Who needs, in fact, who has room for a God to be reaching into the picture and monkeying with the gears of the clock? The clock runs by itself. So the message that later generations draw from Newton's success is a message that Newton would have abhorred, mm-hmm. that we don't need a God. What we need is an engineer to understand the meshing of these gears. Newton was, in that sense, far too successful for his own good.
I just want to make a comment before a question about the transition between medieval and the modern world. I read somewhere that Galileo was appointed court mathematician to, I don't know, the Grand Duke of Florence, but he was really annoyed because the really prestigious position at the Grand Duke was the court astrologer. But I was surprised that in your lecture you didn't mention Plato. It seems to me that a lot of these ideas certainly go back to Plato, and certainly even Pythagoras, who said all things can be reduced to number. When Pythagoras heard some blacksmith pounding away at on some horseshoe, he heard different sounds, and he realized that the sounds of a guitar depend on the ratio of the lengths of the strings and so on, from which he deduced there was a harmony of the universe and everything could be reduced to number. So the ideas that you mentioned certainly go back to Plato, in my opinion, and I wonder if Plato plays any role in your analysis.
That's an awfully good question. It's a pleasure, I would guess, to be rebuked for not having spent enough time on Greek philosophers. Yes, you're absolutely right. These ideas do go back to Plato. The notion that number is the key to all things, and this business that a string of a certain length, when plucked, will give a note, and a string twice that length will give a note in harmony with the first. The Greeks discovered that. They were thrilled with that. But the discoveries about the heavens and things like this, which come later, weren't Greek ones. The Greeks would have been thrilled with this this project that the world is governed by mathematical law. There was a surprise in all this, which that people knew that the heavens were perfect. This was an ethereal domain far away. We couldn't sully it. And so you would expect, and the Greeks expected things there to work precisely and according to plan. The surprise that they found in the 1600s was that life on Earth, the speed that a rock would fall, say, or the path that an arrow would take if you shot it, that those were also governed by mathematical laws was an astonishment. The Greeks never would have guessed that. And then not only was both heaven and earth governed by laws, but it turned out to be the same laws. That was the startling discovery in the 1600s.
I have a more general question. I spent a lot of time on Charles Darwin recently, and what you just said makes me think, well, in a way, Charles Darwin was 200 years later still struggling with the same thing, in a way, slightly modified when he thought about the evolution of things, you know. And it makes me think, wasn't this whole thing more a process, you know, from Plato over the 1600s that were, of course, significant, but, and then you look at the world of today and you look around where people believe, and probably a majority of people still believe that God has his hands on many, if not all, details in the world. So this seems to me more being like a slowly rolling machine or animal, whatever, in a direction that is hopefully positive, but with maybe sometimes some acceleration here and there in the course of these 2,000 years, but it's not a big revolution in one point in time, and after that, is everything different? What do you think about that?
Well, these are good questions. One of the things, let me transform it ever so slightly. One of the things that surprised me during the course of writing this book is that Newton is in the mid-1600s, Darwin is in the mid-1800s. That is to say, it takes 200 years for Darwin to come along. If you were to think about it, Newton, it seems, ought to have been the discovery that comes later. It's mathematical, it's about all these hard things. What Darwin is talking about is barnacles and fossils and foxes and chickens, things right in front of you. How come it took 200 years longer to come up with the easier theory? And the answer, I think, is that it's easier only in that it can be expressed in English instead of in mathematics. But the reason that Newton and all his brilliant peers couldn't come up with evolution was exactly as you say. They couldn't conceive that there could be design without a designer. and there plainly was design. Their whole careers were devoted to explaining just how glorious God's design, God's creation was. So there was never anyone as fervent a believer in intelligent design as Newton and his physicist peers, and it sent them off on a dead end for 200 years.